Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie, as always, joined by John. A little behind the scenes, we've never made it through an entire episode without editing. We made it like 40 minutes the other day, but just now John like moved something during my opening line that we had to start over. That's the earliest we've ever had to edit.
I didn't even get a word out and I've already messed it up.
Jeez, oh Pete, what are we doing? I tell you, we got a whale of a case for you today. You may have seen some things about it on social media, but we got a lot more that has happened that hasn't been on TV or social media. So excited about that. Before then, we want your help.
Yeah, absolutely. We have been kicking around the idea of doing another episode, or I'm sorry, another series of Paradigm or The Left on Dead. And I think we've settled on Paradigm. So we need y'all's help. We want to do something unique. We don't want to do a case that's had a multi-documentary series on it. We want to do one of the lesser known cases that has a different perspective. You know, we want to have different perspectives on the case. So maybe I've not explained that well. Do you have any other thoughts on it?
The word paradigm basically means your point of view for something. So we want to share a case that has multiple points of view to consider, and we want to put all that out there. The first season was the Lillilid murders. We know what happened there, but was everything as it seemed, and were the punishments applied correctly, and what happened behind the scenes with attorneys? We were able to do a really deep dive. So looking for something that we can present multiple sides of. It would need to be a case where we can get access to documents and hopefully to people who are in the know as well. So if you have one of those, let us know. We've put out a request for recommendations over on social media as well, but we're excited to get that one going. That's probably the one thing I think both of us are most proud of, season one of Paradigm.
Absolutely. But we would love to hear from you all. What cases do you have that you would recommend? And if you, for some reason, have a case that's personal and know someone involved that we could speak to, I think that would be really interesting as well. So there's your call to action. Please email us, truecrimecast@gmail.com, or you can find us on any of our social media platforms as well.
At True Crime Cast, everywhere that you find social media things.
Guys, if you have not already checked out True Crime Cast over on Patreon, you are really missing out. For as little as $3 a month, you have access to all of our content early and ad-free, but the biggest perk is you get your very own exclusive episode each and every month. Jamie and I go kind of more lighthearted while we still can talk about some really awful things. I think you get more of our real personalities over there. So go check it out, patreon.com/truecrimecast.
Yeah, but today, this one's for everybody. And this is a case that a lot of people are talking about. It has been covered on Netflix, a documentary called The Crash. It has been covered in a couple episodic shows over on Hulu and some other channels. So it's out there, but not everything's out there. So we wanted to find out, what have the documentaries missed and what's the real story behind Mackenzie Schirilla?
Yeah, before we go further, I think it's important to establish the basics for maybe you haven't seen the documentaries. Maybe you've not seen all the footage that's been out there on like TikTok or whatever. Let's just lay the foundation. So at approximately 5:30 a.m. on July the 31st, 2022, a 17-year-old named Mackenzie Schirilla drove a 2018 Toyota Camry at approximately 100 miles per hour into the side of a brick building in Strongsville, Ohio. This is a suburb about 20 miles southwest of Cleveland. And you can, you know, crime scene analysis can show you like what happened. And usually when you're looking at car accidents, you can see, okay, the brakes were applied here as evidenced by the black marks that they will leave. There were no brake marks at all. This car, 100 miles an hour into a building without even touching the brakes. The vehicle's black box data confirmed the accelerator pedal was fully depressed at 100% for the final 4.6 seconds before impact. Dominic Russo, 20 years old, was in the passenger seat. He was Shirilla's boyfriend. Davion Flanagan, 19 years old, was in the back seat, and he was not wearing a seatbelt. He was a friend, and Russo was pronounced dead at the scene. Flanagan was extra, like, he was removed from the wreckage. He did have a moment where there was a pulse, and he was pronounced dead in the ambulance at the scene. There was a life flight helicopter that was canceled because he didn't end up making it. Mackenzie Shirilla survived, but she did have severe injuries. She had a broken femur, a severely broken arm, three broken ribs, a lacerated liver, a lacerated kidney, and damage to both of her carotid arteries. And she was charged with murder after this. Just want to note too, like, I'm absolutely flabbergasted that she survived. She was, part of her body was underneath the dash. Part of her body was in the passenger side seat. It's anything short of a miracle that she ended up surviving.
And you and I both have teenage drivers in our home. I mean, it's already kind of nerve wracking to have that, but things happen, and I don't know, accidents are going to happen. But this is just such an odd set of, because why was she charged with murder, right? Was this just a car wreck? Were they drinking? Is that why she was accused of it? Was it some kind of substance, or was this something else? So many questions led into these murder charges. And I think at first glance, it just looks like an unfortunate accident.
Yeah. If you see footage of the scene, you can watch the entire body cam footage. Jamie, it looks like the car exploded. It would, if you put it in this room, I don't know that I could tell you what kind of car it was. It is completely mangled.
It was just about cut in half, just pretty much about down the middle. Yeah.
Yeah. It so, hit, I mean, I think it hit like basically a corner of the building.
Yeah.
It and landed. It was awful. It was brutal.
Yeah. And it shows some of that footage in the documentaries, but not necessarily all of it. So let's talk about the individuals that did lose their lives in this crash. Dominic Russo was 20 years old. He was born September of 2001 and grew up in Strongsville with his parents, Christine and Frank Russo. And he had six brothers and sisters. That's a lot. He had been with Mackenzie in an on-again, off-again relationship for about 4 years, since they were both in high school. And they had moved in together in 2021. She's still in high school at this time. It's interesting to think of a circumstance where family members would let, her parents would let her move in with her boyfriend while she's underage, but that's what was happening here.
It takes all kinds to make the world go round, but I'm not one of those parents who would allow that.
Dom's mom, Christine, has been one of the most consistent voices in this case. She spoke at sentencing. She's been on about all the documentaries. She speaks very strongly about everything that she believes happened. She speaks out at public forums about the son that she lost and the relationship that she watched deteriorate in the months before his death. Dominic went by Dom, so we'll call him Dom from here on out. Dom and Davion were robbed of their futures, their hopes, and their dreams, is what Dom's mom said at the sentencing. She went on to say that Mackenzie showed no mercy on Dominic, nor did she on Davion. Only God at this time can have mercy on her soul. Since I mentioned sentencing, she's going to be convicted, but we'll get to the trial a little later. According to Christine, in the months before the crash, she had seen Dom and Mackenzie's relationship become more and more volatile. She watched him call her asking for help because Mackenzie was driving erratically, and she had sent a family friend to pick him up. Again, he's riding with Mackenzie, and she starts driving in very dangerous ways, and he calls home asking for help. John, I don't know what it would take. I don't have a 20-year-old son. I have a 17-year-old son. For him to call me and ask me to rescue him from riding with a girl, I think that's got to, you got to be scared to do that. That's not a, a prideful young man thing to do, right?
No, if your kid calls you and says that, it's something to take pretty seriously.
The Russo family is now pushing for Dom's Law, which is legislation that would block convicted violent offenders from profiting on social media. For a long time, there have been certain circumstances where that would happen with books and writing or selling the rights to a movie, but McKenzie, it looks like, is kind of trying to build a following as an influencer from behind bars. Happy to get into that later if you want to, John. I just don't want to give it too much attention, but the Russo family is fighting against this, against her being able to do so and profit.
Yeah, let's put a pin in that. Actually, I have an opinion that I would like to share on that. Let's move on to Davian Flanagan. He was 19 years old as well. He had grown up in Strongsville along with Dom, and he was part of the same close-knit friend group. And he had a dream. He had ambitions. He wanted to become a barber and open his own shop. He had been working full-time to save money and was in the process of applying to Allstate Hairstyling and Barber College there in Cleveland, and was planning to start in the fall of 2023, but he would never get the chance to do so. He was, you know, if you remember, he was in the back seat. He had nothing to do with the relationship between McKenzie and Dom, but he was, you know, he was an unfortunate bystander, and fortunately he was killed in the car that he got into. His father, Scott, has spoken before, and he spoke at sentencing. He's been very vocal in the aftermath of the Netflix documentary. The Flanagan family started a GoFundMe to fund Davion's barber college dream in his honor, and that's helping to inspire barbers who can't afford tuition. Again, he was only 19 years old, and just so sad and tragic that his life was taken so soon.
And his name gets left out of a lot of these conversations because it was essentially, if you believe she did this on purpose, it was about McKenzie and Dom and their relationship. If you believe that she had an intended target here, it was not Davion. So let's dive into their relationship a little bit more. Again, they've been on again, off again for about 4 years. They've been living together. A lot of people around would characterize their relationship as toxic. A word that came from prosecutors many times during the trial, and the Netflix documentary repeats it over and over again without really diving into the details. What the documentary does show is a relationship marked by frequent breakups, significant fighting, and escalating threats, which I think is the important part. A lot of times, you know, teenagers into your 20s, into your 30s, on again, off again is pretty common, even if you're arguing a lot. But the escalating threats, I think, sets this apart a bit. What it should have shown more carefully, it showed a lot of McKenzie's parents, Natalie and Steve, who were convinced their daughter is innocent and who present her as a caring, protective individual who would never intentionally harm anybody that she loved. Now, her parents have received a lot of backlash since this. Her dad was wearing a t-shirt with the word boom on it, which, if you're talking about a deadly crash, maybe not. Maybe somebody should have flagged that before they rolling.
When you watch it, you had to think that was intentional. That could not be an oversight, right?
Yeah, I would. If it was, it was a terrible oversight. Yeah, and so the documentary doesn't show a lot of the back and forth between McKenzie and Dom. And since then, we have received public records of up to 93,000 text messages documented about their relationship and particularly the escalation of McKenzie's threats toward Dom.
Yeah, in the months before the crash, McKenzie allegedly made multiple explicit threats toward Dom. Videos recovered from the phone, from his phone specifically, showed an altercation in which she was heard repeatedly degrading him, threatening him, and damaging his property. She allegedly threatened to key his car, which means to take a sharp object like keys and scratch his car with it. She allegedly threatened to break the handle of his front door after he refused to let her inside. And critically, approximately 2 weeks before the crash, McKenzie and Dom were driving together when McKenzie allegedly said that she was going to wreck the car on purpose to kill both of them. That's that's premeditation almost, or foreshadowing maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly threatening something that actually happens. And I think this is a key piece that shows that it's not an accident if you say you're going to do it, right? That's part of this.
Absolutely. That's the situation where Dom called his mother from the car and she would send a family friend to pick him up. And this is the incident that, of course, is mentioned in the documentaries. But I don't know. I think it's a really important part of this entire conversation.
That was just 2 weeks before she drove a car at 100 miles an hour into a brick building with him in the passenger seat. No brakes, accelerator all the way down, just like she told him she was going to do. And when we get back from the break, we'll dive into the incident that she wants to say is an accident. It ended up in imprisonment. On the night of July 30th, 2022, Mackenzie, Dom, and Davion had been at a high school graduation party. Phone location data shows the three of them left that party around 5:30 in the morning. Allegedly, they had been there, and we'll talk about what they found in the car in a little bit, but they had been indulging a bit, but nobody really believes that she was uber intoxicated with alcohol when this happened. Now, it's important to show the actual path that she took to the building that they hit, because you can see security footage and surveillance footage of her 2018 Camry making turns, using signals, stopping appropriately. There's no erratic driving. In these videos, it looks like she's in complete control of the vehicle. It's also important to note that none of their homes were on this route, so she really had no reason to be on this road in the first place as she turned on to Progressive Drive. Then you can switch to the footage near the building, where you can see the car accelerating. For 3/4 of a mile, the gas pedal was pushed completely to the floor, and she reached 100 miles an hour. At no point did the brake engage. At 5:32, the Camry struck the PIDCO building, a large brick commercial structure at the intersection of Progress and Almeida Drives. And the impact, like you said earlier, was explosive. And if you look at the way it was split, it's almost as if you picture yourself driving from the side of a building toward the corner, and you let the passenger side hit the corner with the driver's side going toward the open space. That's kind of what it looks like to me. Like it drove, she split it down the middle, and she was going so fast, the car actually split.
Yeah. And it was right at the corner. I can't even describe the look of the car. It is probably the most brutal car wreck I've ever seen. Honestly.
Complete demolition.
The black box data was recovered from the Camry, and it was central to the prosecutor's case. Jamie, I want to go ahead and just stop there. Did you know that cars had black box data?
Really not until the Karen Reed trial did I know that you could tap into the computer system and it shows the level of acceleration. If you hold it down at 70% for 30 minutes, it'll show that. I guess it makes sense since computers are built in now that can be tracked. I think the fact that it's making itself known more and more in the legal system is interesting. If you talk about, I don't know, should they have to have a warrant to get that data? I mean, they could have gotten it here easily, but what are the legalities of that? Because it's something before the last few years I really didn't know a lot about.
Yeah, so it did confirm that the accelerator was 100% depressed. And like you said, the final 4.6 seconds before impact. And it also confirmed critically that there was zero brake engaged at any point in the final moments, or the final seconds rather, before the crash. Investigators also noted in early detail that seemingly was potential, Shirella's fuzzy slipper was found wedged against the accelerator. So is the point there that she was pushing so hard that it was there even after she was dislodged from her position because of the crash?
Well, I think the questions are, if she didn't do this on purpose, what led to it accidentally happening? Was it a medical episode where she was blacked out and couldn't stop pushing the gas? Was it something like an item like her slipper? Like, I think about it, I don't know. As a youngster, I had trash in my car because I was a big loser. So if a Coke can rolled under my brake and I couldn't push my brake, then that would be a problem. So did this slipper cause the accelerator to get stuck? So that's it had a potential to be exculpatory and show that maybe it was a malfunction of the slipper, but I don't know.
If you drive a car made within the last 10 years, you'll notice, especially on the driver's side, that your rug or whatever above your carpet is usually like clipped into place. I drove a car that was sold. It didn't have that. And there was a time where that somehow got pushed up on my accelerator enough to where it pushed the accelerator and I didn't have to. I had to reach down while I was driving to pull that off the accelerator. So, and I have had stuff fall under my brake pedal too, because I was also a teenage boy that was messy.
Yeah.
But did it cause the crash? I don't know. I personally don't think so. Forensic analysis eventually would rule it out. The slipper had become trapped as a result of the impact, not before it. So it could not have caused the acceleration.
I don't understand the science of how you can prove that, but allegedly they believe that they could, and I don't know. That's tough. With as mangled as everything was, doing any kind of reconstruction would have been really tough.
Absolutely. What we do know is that it took approximately 45 minutes before a passerby would come by the scene and realize that they needed to call 911. So officers also collected at the scene some pretty interesting stuff. 8.1 grams of mushrooms, a digital scale, a bong, and a bag of marijuana. And that was all located in the vehicle. Though McKenzie was not found to be impaired by the mushrooms at the time of the crash, and marijuana levels were not believed to have significantly impaired her driving, I think it is important to note what was in the vehicle. McKenzie was found alive. Like I said, she was pinned under the collapsed passenger dashboard, and she was not okay. She was in the hospital for a while and said that she did not know what happened. She said that she must have blacked out. She said the crash was an accident. On November 4th, 2022, she was arrested and she was charged. And the rest is kind of the history.
Yeah. So we'll talk a little bit about what we saw in the documentary, because that is kind of what a lot of the buzz is about. We saw her parents, Natalie and Steve, members of Dom's family, as well as Davion's family, and then some other friends who were very interesting as well. We heard about other victims and especially if you get into the Hulu docs, people who feel like they were victims of McKenzie for years before this happened. And you hear from some investigators, maybe most poignantly, you hear from McKenzie herself. This is the first time that she had spoken on camera since she had been arrested. In the interview with McKenzie, she maintains her innocence. She says that she doesn't remember the crash at all. John, I don't know the last time you were in a serious accident or had any kind of, physical trauma, but a lot of times your mind does block out the few seconds before and after something happens because it's that painful. So the fact that she doesn't remember exactly what happened the few seconds before, I don't know, that's almost believable to me.
I mean, if you saw the car, there's definitely a chance that she got hit so hard she doesn't remember. I had a pretty bad wreck a couple of years ago, but I didn't lose consciousness. It was traumatic, but I still remember it. But even as bad as that wreck was for me, it was minor compared to this.
Yeah, and if you think about it, she started accelerating 3/4 of a mile before she hit. So even if you block out a couple seconds, there's still some things to remember. Why were you even on that road? And that's a question she couldn't answer.
There's an answer for that potentially.
Yeah. So she expresses grief. She's very frustrated by her confession. The documentary presents her account alongside the evidence, and it shows the black box data. It shows the security footage, the body cam footage. It shows some of the trial and then the verdict, the sentencing, the appeals. A lot of it is opinion, though. It's interviewing these people. What did you see? What did you hear? What do you believe? And it doesn't cover all the details of the case, which I think we find in a lot of these documentaries. It's, oh, you conveniently left these three things out that would completely change the opinion of people. So let's start with what they left out, John.
Yeah, for one, 3 days before the crash, her GPS data from her phone placed her at the exact location of the eventual crash. Not in its vicinity, not, you know, half a mile away, but at it, at the intersection of Progress and Almeida Drive, the precise spot where the building that she hit still stands. This is a small brick building. Well, I shouldn't say small, but it looks like a one-story brick building. It almost looked like an old school.
It looked like exactly like every elementary school I've ever seen.
It may have been a school at one point because it definitely looks like one. And for a long time, I thought it was a school. The court specifically noted this during the trial, and this was an obscure route. This was not one that she would have routinely taken. Police and investigators concluded that McKenzie had conducted a dry run, so that this was premeditated. She knew she was going to go down this street through that intersection and into the precise spot of the building. So she drove the route. She saw the road conditions. She saw the building. The Netflix documentary mentions the dry run, but it does not present it as the damning piece of premeditation evidence that investigators treated it as.
Yeah, I mean, it mentions it's in passing, as if like, oh, well, somebody said there was a dry. No, like this happened factually by GPS data that she was there. And even if you try to explain away the accident itself, how can you explain this? It's really tough. One of the biggest things in the entire case that doesn't show up is that after she had this incident, I'm not going to call it an accident, they recorded conversations she had with her mom. She was a suspect pretty quickly. They didn't immediately rule this an accident. They kind of left it open. And especially when they started talking to people, said, we need to pay close attention and see what's going on here. In one of those phone calls, McKenzie asks her mom, can we just tell the police if I had a seizure? Can we please tell them something like that? She was trying to come up with an explanation for a potential medical episode that happened before they had reached her, before she had spoken to an attorney. This is before she knew she was a suspect. This is within hours of killing her boyfriend and one of her close friends. The seizure story really wasn't explored much in the in her conversation with police. Instead, she and her defense team focused on POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. That's a lot of science words. Basically, she does have a condition that can randomly at times cause momentary blackouts. And to be fair, if you're the defense and this is a documented illness somebody has and they were in an accident and say they didn't remember, that sounds like a good foothold to start looking for reasonable doubt, at least.
So this, you know, gets a little stranger. Jamie, have you heard any of the audio from the phone calls that McKenzie makes to her mom from prison?
Bro, I have, and I've tried to figure out what's going on, and I thought I was having a medical episode.
Let's actually listen to it, because I could try to describe it, and I don't think I could do it justice. Agreed. Is that all right?
Yep.
Let's listen to it now.
He said he's like Caesar. He's like he's in his like he's on. He's
like, it's a gibberish or a distortion of the English language. It's kind of like
pigment.
Can we tell the police I had a seizure? Can we tell the police something like that?
Yeah, John, that's, I mean, it's almost like you took a podcast episode and put it on 50 speed.
I've listened to that so many times and I can never hear what was actually said.
In an interview with James Renner, friend of the show, her dad said that it was some type of carny language.
Apparently they had been using this for a long time. This was something weird that this family did.
Yeah, this wasn't developed for secret messages.
But, It's so strange. Like I remember kids in school doing pig Latin. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
But this is so much different, and I could not understand it.
Yeah, but her mom does, and her mom responds to it, and they're able to say things that they don't think other people can understand because they know their calls are being recorded. So it's anytime you're speaking in code, it's not a good look.
Well, and they would have multiple conversations like this, and in one recorded call, because you got to remember, every call that you have while you're in prison is being recorded. The only ones not recorded are confidential calls to your attorney, but any call with just your family members, it's going to be recorded. Anyway, there's one call in particular where she begins speaking in this code, and she's discussing a man that she had been communicating with in jail. Her mother stops her and says, "Don't forget you said, can I say a gibberish term just to make sure?" And then starts going into this. So odd. Natalie then asks in the coded language whether something that she's heard is accurate, and at one point checks by saying, quote, "You're saying rape." And then Mackenzie confirms it. So it's as if they're trying to, I don't know, develop some kind of story together while they're on these calls.
Right. Yeah. And it's, if you're trying to be transparent and seem like you're trying to help an investigation, this is not a good start.
Yeah. And there's another call where Mackenzie goes into the secret language after acknowledging that her cellmate is in the same room. In another, she uses it immediately after saying that she's in a public area with other inmates. You know, how does this not draw some kind of weird attention and they like step in to make sure she's not at least having a stroke or
something know. Else? Yeah. I mean, they certainly, she continued it and they let her do it. I guess you can't, I don't know if freedom of gibberish is part of our constitution or not, but prosecutors were able to decode the language and present some of what she said as evidence during her 2023 murder trial. The fact that Mackenzie was using a private coded language on recorded jail calls in an attempt to communicate these things certainly didn't help her case, but that wasn't in the documentary at all. Not in the Netflix one anyway.
No, according to detective reports filed in the case, a police sergeant told investigators that Steve Shirilla, Mackenzie's father, made a statement in the immediate aftermath of the crash. Steve allegedly told the sergeant that his daughter had intentionally driven her vehicle into the building in an attempt to take her own life. So not necessarily to murder, but an attempt to commit suicide.
And a little foreshadowing to the trial, whether or not the crash was intentional becomes the main decision here. And here Steve is saying she probably did it on purpose.
In the documentary, Steve is one of his daughter's most passionate defenders. He says there's zero evidence of intent. He says he will never stop fighting for her. But at the same time, you said that your daughter had intentionally driven her vehicle into the building in an attempt to take her own life. That's talking out of both sides of your mouth, sir. Right?
Yeah, it really is. It's trying to cover up what you had previously said.
The alleged statement he made to a police sergeant in the days after the crash are not in the documentary. So we are reporting it for what it is, an allegation documented in a detective's report, which Steve disputes. Another interesting note, May 18th, 2026, 3 days after the crash premiered on Netflix, Steve Shirilla was placed on administrative leave from his job, where he is an art and digital media teacher at Mary Queen of Peace Catholic School in Cleveland. The school sent a letter to families saying that it was investigating claims that a teacher had, quote, demonstrated poor judgment, end quote. So this is impacting him in a very personal way, even still as he's placed on leave after the documentary was aired.
And to be clear, this wasn't after the trial. This wasn't after the crash. This was after the documentary where he made these public statements. You can find his interview. Just search Steve Shirilla, James Renner, and you can see him go into this a little bit more in depth, but he seemed completely blindsided by this. A little bit more about what came from people in the documentary versus what didn't. One of Mackenzie's biggest defenders was her friend Rosie Graham. In the documentary, she speaks warmly of Mackenzie's character. She vouches for her. What it doesn't mention is that police records contain a reference to Graham telling people not to get in the car with Shirilla. The same person who defended her publicly had reportedly warned friends privately not to get in the car because she was dangerous. Since the documentary aired, Graham has issued a public statement saying she did not pick sides in this case. That statement did not address the police record reference. Police records also cite Snapchat videos allegedly recorded by McKenzie in April of 2022, 3 months before the crash, in which a speedometer is visible reaching 93 miles an hour in active traffic. And these videos, again, were not in the documentary.
I've seen all kinds of videos just in my TikTok algorithm because of what we do, I guess. But there's a lot of videos out there of her, and there's some of her and Dom going through. Have you seen the video of them randomly going through an abandoned church?
Yeah.
And yeah, just some of the stuff they say, it's blasphemous. Anyway, there's another documentary that covers the case, and it speaks with former classmates of McKenzie's, and they describe a side of her that the Netflix film did not explore. Multiple classmates characterize her as dominant, aggressive, and retaliatory towards people that she perceived as enemies. One classmate described a specific detail, saying that McKenzie kept a list of people that she didn't like, and also what she wanted to do to each of them. You know, it's one thing to have a mental note of people that you don't like, but it's another to write them down, especially nowadays.
And this is in an episode on Hulu called The Mean Girl Murders. And that's what this reminds me of, the burn book from Mean Girls.
Absolutely. One girl said that just being around her was a toxic environment to even be in her presence. So another described her as the meanest girl in school who tore everybody down. But to be fair, a character statement or character evidence of this kind is not the same at all as evidence of murder. There are plenty of difficult people in the world. There's plenty of people who are aggressive or unkind, especially in adolescence. And those people are not always violent criminals. So we're not at all presenting this as material to be used as proof, but it's just a little bit of her backstory. So I think it is important.
One more piece that wasn't covered in the documentary, and that's some things that happened pretty directly after the crash. While Dom and Davion had just been killed, she was recovering in the hospital from what ended up being severe injuries. And we can get into intent here in a little bit. If you can't carry this out, if it was your intent to hit the school, you can't assume you're going to live through it. So I wonder how much she was surprised, if this was intentional, to actually wake up. But she started posting videos from her hospital bed immediately upon waking up and regaining consciousness. There was no element of mourning and taking time away from any type of attention or spotlight. She jumped into the middle of it. She was later, and some of these things were shown in passing in some of the Hulu material. And John, for example, there are pictures of her at a wheelchair at a concert in the months after the crash. I don't think that's a big deal. Like, she's in a wheelchair because she needed to be, but her going out to concerts doesn't show me that she's irreverent or that she had anything to do with this. It could be, hey, you've been through a lot in the last month. Let's go have this night out. Like, that doesn't bother me.
If my kid was ever involved in an accident that was truly an accident and he unfortunately had lost a friend in that as a result of their death, I would want to take my kid out and to try to restore some kind of life to them. I mean, I can't imagine what he would be going through. Now, that is totally different if you believe that she did this intentionally. But even still, like you said, it doesn't show anything as far as proof that she doesn't feel any certain way.
However, about 3 months after the crash, we end up at Halloween. And she and some of her friends dressed up as corpses. You can see that Davion's dad went public about how her posting these Halloween pics, and I'll just quote him here. He says, dressing up as corpses 3 months after she killed two people, and again, he's insinuating she did this on purpose, is just sickened us to the very core. We're not seeing her post videos of her mourning or videos of her regret. I gotta say, again, proof of nothing, but it's really bad judgment for her to be dressing up as a dead person coming out of this situation. And prosecutors used all of this at sentencing as evidence to show she had no remorse so that she could get a bigger sentence.
Somehow I find this more tasteful than her father's boom shirt during the documentary.
Neither's a good look.
Because good one look. Of them is a full-grown adult and the other one is not.
Right. Yeah. No, good points. Good points.
In the 93,000 text messages between McKenzie and Dom, some of those were, you know, those were all reviewed during the 2023 murder trial. But this year, May 27th, 26th, 12 days after the documentary premiered, Strongsville police released roughly 32,000 of them to the public. And what came out of that was really just a picture of their relationship that was very, I don't know, very toxic, very pressured, if you will. In January of 2020, this was 2.5 years before the crash, some of those texts are present for public to review. McKenzie sent Dom a message saying that she was going to kill someone because he couldn't pick her up for when she needed a ride. And later that same day, the argument escalated between them, and she wrote, "I just want to bang my head out on the or bang my head on the wall until I'm dead." In another message to him, she said that he should treat a girl who would die for you a little better. These are, I don't know, if there wasn't an accident, not an, if there wasn't the crash the that crash. Ended up killing yeah. people, these texts, while not great, are pretty normal texts for teenagers in a way. I mean, to be clear, troubled teenagers.
Yeah, appropriate, but, no. Encouraged, no. Abnormal, also not known.
But when you take all of these things together, you know, you just see a troubled, broken child.
And it just gets worse. We get to March of 2022, which is just 4 months before the crash. And Dom texted, "McKenzie hit me and tried to throw a rock at me." So we're escalating from threats and I don't know.
Probably should not have been living with each other.
Probably not. Probably should have been removed from it if they already were. Later that same month, he warned her that she was driving like a maniac. And again, this is in text messages that he's sending to her. "You hit me, you threw a rock at me, you're driving like a maniac." In another exchange, McKenzie accused Dom of trying to harm her during a heated argument while she was allegedly driving erratically. So she says that he tried to physically hurt her while she was driving. And there are some debates about whether or not the steering wheel was grabbed or turned during leading up to the crash. But if you're the defense, you might say that somebody tried to grab it from her. Even the prosecution could say they were trying to defend themselves. So it's just a really weird dynamic there. And she texted and said, "Do you think I would have my car started with you in it knowing you just tried to kill me?" So, yeah, we mentioned troubled teens. My kids, like, I monitor their communications relatively and do as much as I can to protect them and give them autonomy. But so much talk about killing each other, this does seem to be very unusual, I believe.
As a parent, I can't help but be judgmental. If you know your kids in such a toxic relationship, you got to intervene somehow. I mean, but at the same time, they're basically adults, whether you like it or not, and they ultimately have the choice to make. But man, this is just devastating to watch.
And in part of their on again, off again relationship, we see a text where he says, "Kenzie, you know I love you, but I don't think we should be together at this point. There isn't very much time on Earth." I don't think that's a threat. I think he's just saying
life's too short to be unhappy.
Absolutely. And he said, "I'd like to think we could stop fighting, but it's a breakup fight every week. Neither of us deserves that." So he's 20 years old. It sounds like he's trying to break things off. And less than a month later, he's in a car that hits a wall and he loses his life. Nothing in the messages released suggests criminal conduct by Dom. aside from her saying that you tried to kill me while I was driving. But yeah, all this, again, him trying to break it off less than a month before the crash. And the crash happens that we've already described. She's arrested. And John, tell us about the trial.
Yeah, she was actually charged with 12 felony counts, 4 counts of murder, 4 counts of assault, and 2 counts of aggravated vehicular homicide, 1 count of drug possession, and 1 count of possessing criminal tools.
Wait, you said 4. There are 2 people that were killed.
Yeah, I was going to say, so the criminal tools, I'm assuming, are the scales that were used for potentially weighing out the mushrooms. But yeah, that wasn't I didn't say a typo. It was 4 counts of murder. Jamie, only 2 people died. What's up with that?
Yeah. In Ohio, it allows for prosecutors to file multiple murder theories for a single act. So she faced 2 counts of murder per victim, 1 for causing their death as a proximate result of committing a felony, and 1 for purposefully causing their death. So that's why there's 4 murder counts, 2 for each person, 1 for doing it while committing a felony, and 1 for the murder itself. So it's kind of like an aggravating addition to the murder charge. But it is very confusing to read it.
We've covered cases for almost 10 years. I don't remember ever seeing that law, so that is interesting. Her defense team made pretty interesting decisions a couple of times. First, you've heard us say over and over that this was not a jury trial. Well, that's because she waived, and her team waived, a jury trial. So this would be in front of just a judge, meaning only one person would rule and decide the verdict. I don't know the rationale behind that. I think for me, you would want the opportunity to have a hung jury, right? But well, so you're not going to have that with a judge. Maybe that, I don't know what the odds are on that.
Yeah, I don't know what the odds are. My thought is that if she gets in front of a jury, maybe her defense team thinks that they will sympathize more, like vote more with their hearts towards saying she's guilty, whereas a judge may be more technical and be able to say, well, technically she didn't do this on purpose or whatever. So that's my thought, but I don't know how legit that is.
Yeah. I mean, technically you don't really know 100% if this was on purpose or an accident. I think you have all the evidence you need to assume that it was on purpose. But at the end of the day, I think there's still a vague question. Is there, or am I making that up?
Well, I mean, that's what the jury had to decide. That's what it came down to, is essentially the way the laws are written in Ohio, since 2 people died as a result of this crash, they only had to prove that McKenzie intentionally crashed the car, not that she wanted somebody to die. And the judge believed that they proved beyond a reasonable doubt that she did it on purpose.
Right. So that's interesting. That's kind of a caveat to the way they try you for murder in Ohio, that your actions resulted in a death, whether it was intentional or not.
The trial lasted for 4 days, and on August 14th, 2023, in Cuyahoga County in Ohio, Common Pleas Judge Nancy Margaret Russo, not related to Dom, read her verdict. And she did not read it quietly. She said, "This was not reckless driving. This was murder." She described McKenzie's actions as controlled, methodical, deliberate, intentional, and purposeful. She said McKenzie had a mission that she executed with precision. She said the mission was death, literally hell on wheels. She went on to say McKenzie alone chose a time to make the drive early in the morning, when any reasonable person would expect few people would be nearby to witness it or offer life-saving assistance. McKenzie, when she heard this, broke down in tears, and if you see the footage, she looks genuinely shocked. Judge Russo sentenced her to 2 concurrent terms of 15 years to life. Now, concurrent, again, essentially 1 year counts for 2, right? So if she has 2 sentences for 15 years, if they're concurrent, that's still just a total of 15 years. I've always preferred consecutive sentences. That means they're back to back. So she would actually have 30 years, but people would say that if something happens in the first 15, then she doesn't actually serve anything for the second victim, but this way she's serving them at the same time. I don't like that. I think they should be consecutive. The judge noted at sentencing that she did not believe McKenzie would be out in 15 years regardless, because she didn't believe, given her character, that she would be able to show remorse.
We can quickly go through the appeals, but there is an interesting note in here. So September of 2024, the 8th District Court of Appeals upheld the conviction on direct appeal, finding that there was no merit in McKenzie's claims of insufficient evidence or trial errors. So in February of 2025, her legal team filed for an appeal to the Ohio Supreme Court. And in April of 2025, the Ohio Supreme Court declined to hear the case. That left one remaining avenue for a post-conviction relief petition. Her attorneys filed that petition. Jamie, would you believe me if I told you that they missed the deadline by one day filing that appeal?
You know, I feel like that happened in another recent case that they
recently that happened. Yeah, that's insane.
But this one's even more weird. Why?
They failed to account for 2024 being a leap year. In March of 2026, the 8th District Court of Appeals upheld a lower court's decision denying the petition because it was filed 366 days after the trial. This was one day past the statutory deadline because of the leap year day.
And it was counted as 365 days, not one year, because one year would be January 1st to January 1st or whatever. That extra day, I actually hate this. I feel like it's a letter of the law, not just the intent of the law, but wild circumstance.
This would infuriate me if I'm in prison and feel like I'm actually innocent, but that's the law.
This is something the courts stick to. If there's a deadline to file something and you don't hit it, there's very little ground for forgiveness on
with
this
as many cases
anywhere
as there are in every region of this country. If you do not stick to the rules, everybody can be late all the time, and it's an utter circus.
I don't know why you wait that long to file it anyway. Why are we not filing it a month before this, just to be sure? I don't know.
That's a great question.
On April 27th, 2026, McKenzie's new legal team filed yet another appeal with the Ohio Supreme Court. This one makes two arguments. First, that the clock on the post-conviction petition should have started later because a separate transcript was filed weeks after the main trial record, meaning the file actually wasn't complete. So that way the clock starts later, they had more days to fulfill it, and their petition actually wasn't late. The second claim is that McKenzie received ineffective assistance of counsel because her original attorneys failed to adequately investigate a pre-existing medical condition that could have caused her to black out at the wheel. They didn't dig deep enough into the POTS condition that she claimed that she had, and they say they believe they have enough medical evidence to support this claim. The Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office has called for the appeal to be denied and thrown out, and they say we're confident that any court that reviews this case will come to the same conclusion. As of this recording, the Ohio Supreme Court has not decided whether or not they're even going to hear this case.
We can go into some more just interesting stuff about this, these phone calls from prison after the trial. So in one call that was obtained by TMZ, you can hear McKenzie complaining to her mother about boredom. She says that she doesn't have the commissary access that she would like. And she's talked about reading a book and time is moving slowly. She mentions that people with charges like hers aren't allowed to get jobs inside the facility. And then she switches to the coded language and tries to explain why she hasn't asked staff about it. In another call, she and Natalie get excited that the case has been picked up by the Daily Mail in the UK. And McKenzie says, well, maybe Kim Kardashian will reach out herself. And McKenzie starts laughing. Her mother says that she's hoping for exactly just that. McKenzie then describes the charges against her as insane. And she says, quote, it tried to make it look like something that it's not. She would go on to say, quote, I didn't do this on purpose. Like, I got in a car accident. I'm a third victim, End quote.
There are other conversations they have about her begging her mom to send her an iPad. There are conversations about her being excited when she hears the case made the Today Show news. Like, it's just so lack of awareness, lack of remorse, lack of, lack of everything, lack of presence of mind for sure, as they act like this is an opportunity for her to become famous. John, there are other weird things that have come out since the documentary. She sends several texts to her dad at like 2 and 3 in the morning asking for warm milk. And if you go and Google that or look it up on Urban Dictionary, can be a number of awful things that is not actual milk. Just a weird relationship there. And she has been finding a way to take pictures online, and she is sending those to her mother to post on social media to try to build up her role as an influencer.
That's insane. And I think that could kind of tie back into the conversation I wanted to have earlier, if that's okay. Is she allowed to monetize herself? Like, if she's posting these pictures and potentially videos and makes money off of them, should she be allowed to do that?
I'm sure that,
because I feel like I've seen other cases where any money that she would make from this would have to go to the victim's family.
So I think, and it probably depends on the state. Obviously, Ohio is weird here. But I think the statute is that you can't make money off of the crime. So if you write a book about the crime, if you sell a movie about the crime, you can't get that money. But if it's just our big college sports fans, if it's just your name, image, and likeness, I don't know that they can keep you from doing that. Given current statutes, I could be wrong. If somebody knows better, please correct me. But I do think at this point she can benefit financially from this. And that's why Dom's family is trying to push for Dom's law.
I would think that a good, well-spoken attorney could make the case that the public only knows about you because of the evil things that you did. Therefore, your influence and any money thereof goes back to the victims.
Yeah.
I would hope.
Yeah. And I think at this point, she's been convicted. We don't have to say alleged. Like, at this point, she's a convicted murderer. There are reports from inside the prison that she introduced herself as Sharilla the Killer. I don't know if that's, I'm not a big prison snitch guy. If you've ever listened to the show before, I don't really put much stock in what they say, but what they keep saying about her being hard to deal with. She's been in trouble several times, a lot for not necessarily violence, but for doing things like manipulating her clothing outside of standards of inside the prison. So those things fall into character for what we saw before the crash.
Yeah. Jamie, I think at the end of the day, this is a broken person who shattered the lives of two other families. And I hope that she doesn't see the light of day in 15 years from the time she was sentenced. I hope that it is a whole lot longer.
She's going to have to be a different person, I think, for it to be even considered.
I see zero remorse.
Right. And we're 3 years into this, 4 years since the crash itself, and she shows zero remorse, takes zero responsibility. I don't know, man. It's I feel like Netflix gave her a lot of leash here, and you can see her at the end of it talking to her attorneys, making sure she said all the right things and whatever that may be. But if you read everything involved, go and look at the text messages, go and watch interviews with those that were impacted, read the trial transcripts, you see a completely different person than Netflix presents. And I even thought she was guilty after the Netflix thing, so I'm even more convinced now. I do think she did this on purpose. Is there a reasonable doubt in your mind?
No, I think she did this on purpose. I think if you hit the gas full pedal for 5 seconds and don't even try to hit the brakes, you were going full steam ahead, knowing that you were trying to kill everyone in that car.
Absolutely.
I think her plan was for none of them to survive.
My hope for this, because there's so many documentaries that are really, the high school catfish one was wild. Like, so many of these documentaries are becoming more and more popular the more they come out. And I just hope we are able to set up some regulations about profiting off of the quote unquote fame you get from that, or even the exposure of it. I even go to Gypsy Rose Blanchard, who is came out as a as an influencer almost after killing her mom. Like, we need to get a handle on this.
What's the lady down in Florida that we all think killed her?
Well, she was never convicted, so that's
But she's
Casey Anthony.
Casey Anthony now has a following.
Yeah, she was found innocent. So
Bonnie and Clyde would have had a tremendous TikTok following with their TikTok lives, but I mean, it's a tale as old as time. People love crime.
People love fame and people love attention, and that's what we see here. So note to those of you with kids, or if you are a teenager, be a good person. Get people to be a good person.
And if you're not a good person, be an aware parent and don't let them drive.
Right. Yeah. There got to be guidelines in place to stop this. John, we've gone over an hour, one of our longest episodes in a really long time, but this one was, I don't know, just so much to it, so much that has been left off of television. So we wanted to fill in some gaps and hope we've done that thoroughly.
Absolutely. Guys, if you enjoy what you're listening to, do us a couple of favors. The most important, leave a rating and a review. It's been a long time, and I'm a little sad.
I'll read those at the top of the show if you send them in.
And if you feel so inclined and you want to join us over on Patreon, by all means. But if not, that's fine. But leave a rating and a review. We would really appreciate it.
Yep, we really appreciate you guys. We'll be back with another case next week.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.